you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Well, welcome back to the Golf Advisor Podcast. I'm Brandon Tucker here with Jason Deegan, and we are coming to you from the Lodge at Pebble Beach. Few better places to do a podcast from in the country when it comes to golf settings. And we just got off the course at Pebble. Jason, I know you've been to this course a little more than I have. I really haven't spent much time here, and you've been here a fair amount, but what did you think of the setup? We're about a few weeks away from the U.S. Open. It didn't seem that... I mean, there it had its moments, I think, but overall, I mean, it still felt a little resorty, in my opinion. What about you?
Yeah, no, I feel like you know Pebble Beach, even if you haven't played it. So you know the shape of the shot. You know the shape of the hole. So even though you're staring at a 25-yard fairway, you know what you have to do. So it doesn't entirely seem as scary or as intimidating as maybe a narrow U.S. Open course would feel like. So, you know, it was certainly challenging. We certainly had some wind. You know, the marine layer moved in a little bit on us. But yeah, definitely still an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, overall, I felt like it was self-inflicted wounds and not awful, you know, breaks and, you know, the greens. One of the things that it just sticks out to me right now is how this place gets a lot of play, and they're going to keep playing until a week before the Open, and the course out there is pure. The greens are rolling great. You know, you barely see any ball marks on them. The fairways are just are awesome. I know they've had a lot of rain out here, so growth hasn't been a problem. The rough, to me, you know, I had some good lies and bad lies in them. There were a few times where I could make a play out of it, and there were a few times I couldn't. I had that one up and down from the fence on that par three on the back. But yeah, I've played Oakmont before, and that was grueling. This wasn't grueling. You know, what, 1.5 club win today, would you say? I mean, it was out there, but it wasn't awful by any means.
Well, I think it was all about if your rough was into you or down, or if your ball was, you know, lying so the rough was going with the shot. Then you could get club on it, and then you could hit a solid shot as long as, you know, the ball wasn't sitting at the bottom of it. But yeah, you could definitely advance it. It wasn't like you had to do the hack out sideways with the 9-iron. I hit some hybrids out of the rough. I hit some, you know, 7-6 iron. So it kind of depended on the lie, but yeah, overall, it'll be interesting to see how it affects those guys in a month.
Sure, I'm still processing the whole 18 holes. I mean, there is just so much going on out there, scenery-wise, and just ambiance, and you know, there's a lot of activity going on right now with the, and there's just tourists everywhere too, just people coming and taking pictures and all that. I mean, it's a busy place. You know, I was in St. Andrews last year, and it's similar but different. And, you know, it's a bustling place. We're not like remote Bandon or something. Like, we are in a hub, and there's a lot of activity, and everyone knows they're in a special place. And so I think that was cool to me. You know, it's a kind of a similar but different thing to St. Andrews. St. Andrews is obviously part of the town. We're not really in a town here, but
well, they made a point of it to say several times in the press conference today that this is a national treasure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they try to like to keep the quote-unquote doors open for if you're just coming through, driving through and not playing the course, you can still walk to the 18th green and take photos. Mm-hmm. They have bus tours that stop and unload people to take photos. Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff going on with grandstands being built, and a lot of groups have caddies, so there's 5 and 6 people out there, so in a foursome. So yeah, there's a lot going on, but you're so distracted by views and wind and shots, and It's almost overwhelming the first time you play it, and even this is my third or fourth time, and I'm still kind of grasping what it's all about.
So we were in a shotgun, so we tee off on three, which isn't an ideal starting hole, but I mean, within a hole we're like on the water and we're on the ocean. Within a couple holes we're on six, which six just blew me away. That hole, I mean, you kind of know going in what you're up against, and then you get up to that tee box and you just look out there, and it's just that is a surreal shot. And then you get to seven, and then you get to eight. I didn't really realize how blind the tee shot was at eight. And then you get up there and it's just this great reveal at nine, and then 10, it just keeps coming. And then even in the inland holes, I mean, I know some people knock the inland holes just cause they're not on the water, but, there were some good looks down the stretch too. 17, that's a hard shot.
Like our caddy said, his favorite approach is to 16 green. Yeah. So, you know, you hit a shot out to the middle of the fairway and it mm-hmm. kind of bends right, and kind of have to kick a field goal between, you know, some groves mm-hmm. of trees to, and then that green is so tilted. It's almost a guaranteed three putt for anybody yeah. that plays it first time.
Small greens rolling so nicely. You know, we were talking on the course, like the idea of like POA ruining a putt. Like, we didn't have POA problems out there today whatsoever. This was pure conditions. Obviously softer than what like a Lynx course is with fescue and all that, but it was still an excellent experience. And I'm already wondering like when I'm coming back, because I feel like the round was simultaneously, you know, 5.5 hour shotgun kind of corporate style, and yet I feel like it flew by in a way. You know, it's there's some shots I want back for sure, 18 and all that, but just probably there's no more stimulating golf course than here that I've seen, just from start to finish.
Well, for me being here in the past, what was really eye popping or caught my eye attention is how they're growing the fescue and kind of the wispiness around mm-hmm. the bunker. So like, I hit some shots I thought were in bunkers, and when I got up there, I wished they were in the bunker, because mm-hmm. they were stuck on this downhill slope of the sand, and, you know, there's tall grass all around you, and you just have to pray you hit a decent enough shot to get it on the green. So it really adds the visual appeal, kind of the intimidation, and also the shot making. Where some of those guys are going to end up in what feels like kind of Whistling Straits lies, where there's a lot of funky, chunky grass that will grab your ball when you mm-hmm. think it's in the bunker.
It was certainly, I was expecting like finer edges for sure, and I came out here and I did see more long grass than I was expecting. Let's talk about what we did before the round. We had an interview with a local guy that you really wanted to speak to, had some good insight. Let's talk a little bit about that. Who'd you want to bring in and why?
Well, I've met George Kelly almost immediately after I moved out here to the Bay Area 5 years ago, because he's just, you know, very influential. Everybody kind of knows George, and everybody respects and likes George. He developed Stevenson Ranch, which was a very popular and well-regarded course here. Unfortunately, it closed a couple of years ago. Just because of its location wasn't ideal, and the land was more valuable ranching than it was as a mm-hmm. golf course. And now he's involved in the renovation and restoration at Karika Park. Mm-hmm. But we brought him on because he's maybe the luckiest guy I know. He grew up on Pebble Beach. Mm-hmm. He lived in a house off the first hole, and you know, he played the course hundreds of times growing up. So he has 50 years of experience here at Pebble. He even caddied at the 1972 U.S. Open. So, I mean, he's just a guy that really knows, has a real connection with this place.
Yeah, you know, I did enjoy the conversation. Everything from his time spent with Seve Ballesteros here to operating a golf course in the Bay Area. It's a tough business, especially in Northern California, with everything that they're going through with water insecurity and climate and everything, and just skyrocketing costs. So kind of a multifaceted conversation, from Pebble to Bay Area to owning and operating a golf course, going from Stevenson to Karika. So we hope you all enjoy the conversation. I'm sure we'll all be tuning into the Pebble Beach U.S. Open in early June, and we hope you enjoy it.
Good morning. So here we are with George Kelly, the CEO and founder of Greenway Golf, which is a management and restoration company here in the Bay Area dealing with golf courses. George, I'm really jealous of some of your stories from your childhood. You grew up on a house on Pebble Beach. Just talk a little bit about what that experience was like.
Well, it was pretty amazing. I was with some friends last night and talking about it. And when you're a kid, you don't realize how special it is until you leave and you go away and you come back. And, you know, now I realize it was just unbelievable to grow up there. And my dad said, "We're moving." I said, because I'm from a ranching family in the San Joaquin Valley. And so we're moving. I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "Pebble Beach." I said, "Pebble what? Where's that?" And so we came over here, and I initially hated it because I didn't have any friends, and I was real involved in sports and stuff. And my dad said, "You know, if you shut up long enough, I'll get you some golf lessons, and you might like it." And so my dad was a golfer, and he got me some golf lessons, and I took to it like a duck to water, and kind of the rest is history.
Now, tell me a little bit about how many times you think you've played this golf course, and how intimately do you know it?
Well, it's hard to believe, but back in those days, we had Pebble Beach back in those days was owned privately by Sam Morse, one man.
And yeah,
He lived in the middle of the first fairway, about three houses down from where we lived, which was on the first green. And Sam was an older man. You didn't see him much. But anyway, it was really kind of underutilized in terms of the asset. And he sold, they had a family membership, $450 a year, unlimited golf for everybody in the family. So my dad even had a golf cart, and I kept it under the house, and he had his own golf cart he would take out and drive around and play Pebble, you know. So I played, I can't even begin to tell you, from the time I was, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, then I jokingly say when I discovered girls, maybe I didn't play quite as much, but I played almost every day. I'd come home at least five holes. So my choice was to play, I'd always go out onto the second tee, and then I'd play, if I'm going to play nine, if I had time for nine, I'd play 2, 3, 4, 5, and then cut over to 15 and play 15, 16, 17, and 18. And when I cut over, oftentimes I had to, it was like that little kid in that Top Flight commercial where I was really short and small in those days, and I'd walk up carrying my bag, and I'd say, "Excuse me, do you mind if I play the last few holes with you?" And they'd kind of oftentimes reluctantly look at me, and then I'd stand up and just rip it, and they'd go, "Oh, okay.
We'll bring you along."
And so that was the nine-hole loop, and they'd get to 18 and play one. The shorter route was 2, 3, 17, 18, and 1. That was five holes. But I did that hundreds of times a year.
So to put that in perspective for everybody, a round of golf at Pebble Beach now is $525 for one round, and your whole family was playing all year round for less than that. That's amazing.
Isn't that unbelievable? Yeah.
And, you know, just what does Pebble Beach mean to you? I mean, you've been connected with this property for 50 years, basically. You just talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's just, my kind of love affair with golf began here. And, it just... you just don't know, you get a lot of opportunities in life and there's forks in the road, and you go and you do something, and the next thing you know, here I am in the golf business today. I never would have been in the golf business had I not been here at Pebble Beach and growing up playing golf, and then I played competitively, and then I played professionally for 3 years. So, I mean, it all started here, and I learned to play here. Cam Puget was the head pro at Pebble, and his brother Henry was the pro over at Cypress Point, and Cam was just a great guy, and oftentimes late in the afternoon he'd get a cart and go out and watch me play a few holes, you know, and he gave me playing lessons. And so I was totally indebted to, you know, Pebble for all that it's provided me and the avenues it's opened for me in the golf business. And I come back here and I see it as so different, you know. Obviously today a kid wouldn't have that opportunity because there are no annual passes and that sort of thing. But I was just very fortunate and blessed. And as I said earlier, I didn't really realize that until I left. And then you know, I realized for the first time I was just very, very lucky.
So you mentioned to me you played with Seve Ballesteros here at Pebble Beach. How old were you, and how did that experience go?
Well, that was pretty amazing, actually. That was one of my, you know, most memorable rounds. So 1975, I played the European Tour, and we were at St. Andrews, and Bruce Osborne, who ran our tour group and took care of all of our travel and accommodations and everything, he's we were on the bus one day, and he said, "Hey guys, the European head of the European Tour has asked me for a favor." And he's got a 18-year-old Spanish kid that apparently has got a lot of talent, but he doesn't have any money. So we're going to help him out, and he's going to travel with us. So be nice to him, be friendly to him, and all that, you know. And he got on the bus, and he was like a deer in the headlights. You know, he was didn't speak a word of English and was very kind of shy and timid, and no one said anything to him except for me. And I don't speak Spanish, but I speak enough to say, you know, "Hey, Seve, me llama Jorge, George, you know, ¿cómo está?" and blah, blah, blah. So he, that was 1975. In 1976, so he traveled with us, and I tried to, you know, reach out to him as much as I could. In 1976, he's famous for finishing second in the British Open when he had that chip at Troon through the between the bunkers, and he finished second to Miller. And so in 76, I'm playing down in Australia, and he's playing a practice round with Nicklaus, and he sees me, and he runs over, because he never forgot the fact that I was really nice, and he embraced me, and he calls me, Kelly, how are you? You know, ¿cómo está? And blah, blah, blah. And then later that year at the tour school qualifying, I said, "Seve, I live in Pebble Beach, and if you ever are out to the West Coast, and you want to play Pebble Beach," he said, "call me." You know, this is obviously before cell phones and everything. It wasn't easy to get a hold of someone. And I come home one night, my mom says, "Hey, this Spanish-speaking kid called, and I think he said it was Seve." I said, "Oh, Seve called." So I called him back. He was down in Los Angeles, and he said, "I'd like to come up and play, you know, next week if I can." I said, no problem. What day, you know? And so I tried to find a couple other guys to play with, and no one was available. So I ended up playing the first time Seve played here in a twosome with Seve, and my brother, younger brother Kevin, speaks Spanish, so he caddied for Seve, and it was one of the most memorable days of my life. I mean, Seve hit some shots that I'll never forget, you know, and primarily a bunker shot he hit on 14. He was just rolled into the front of the bunker in two, and he was on a downslope with 1 foot out of the bunker and 1 foot in, and the pin was on that top deck, and I would have had to go out sideways, you know. He opened up the blade like a pancake flipper and just lofted this thing straight in the air and to about a foot from the hole, and I looked at him, I said, "Wow."
That's a scary shot, even with a good lie, yeah. So to pull something off.
"Seve, how do you do that?" He goes, "I'm the number two best bunker player in the world." He says, "Gary Player, number one, he taught me that shot." I'll never forget it.
So who won? You remember?
Oh, I don't know. We didn't have a bet or anything. It was just kind of more just a kind of a beautiful
just
walk
a camaraderie
in the park.
Event. Yeah.
But I mean, he was fantastic even in those days. I mean, he was his brilliant. I mean, he'd already finished second in the British Open, you know, so. Pretty big, you know, he was on his way.
Yeah, so you, you've been to every Open at Pebble. There's been five of them. This will be the sixth this year. And the very first Open, 1972, you were a caddy. So just talk real quick about that experience.
I was. So back in those days, the players couldn't bring their own caddies. So all the caddies were, you know, not volunteers, but they would recruit some of the better players on the, you know, the at these venues to be caddies for the tournament, and so there's 156 players in the tournament, so there's 156 caddies, and it was like on a Sunday we all gathered down at the old putting green, which was just as you walk in now, and you know 156 caddies are standing there, and then very few players. But I made the mistake of they pulled my name. And I'm the caddy, and George Kelly, and then they pulled the player's name, and it was a fellow from Texas. His name was Ron something, like Ron Weaver. And I jokingly said, "Wow, it looks like I'm going to be home on the weekend watching the tournament." And and the player, Ron, was standing right behind me. It was so embarrassing. He goes, "I'm Ron Weaver." And I said, "Oh, nice to meet you, Mr. Weaver. And I said, he said, listen, you don't know if I can play, and I don't know if you can caddy. Let's go find out. And, you know, I probably should have been replaced because he was obviously very upset with my comment and never asked me for one bit of advice the whole week. And, of course, he missed a cut.
That was the end of your caddy career, I guess.
That was pretty much the end of it, yeah.
Well, you know, Pebble Beach has changed a lot since 1972. Not necessarily the holes, but just kind of the feel. And the lodge and everything, the Fairway One villas have built up around it. What's your kind of perception of how things have changed?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Pebble was clearly an underutilized asset. And, you know, over time, people started to realize that, you know, this had so much potential. And especially when they started bringing, you know, the 72 was the first open. So, I mean, it was kind of always under the radar. And then once they started having major championships here, I think the 77 PGA was here. As a matter of fact, it was a sudden-death playoff with Gene Littler and Lanny Watkins. And I saw Littler make a putt on the first green. That was just unbelievable for a par to extend it. But, you know, they just basically modernized the golf course. The biggest change, obviously, is the fifth hole. Mm-hmm. So the fifth hole was arguably one of the weakest holes on the golf course before. It kind of went up through the canyon. And the property where the current fifth hole is now was privately owned by a fellow that kind of homesteaded there and would never sell. And then finally, I guess about 15 or 20 years ago, he sold the property to the Pebble Beach Company. And they built a magnificent hole. I mean, five right now is, you know, I mean, people could say it's one of the best holes on the golf course.
Yeah, Jack Nicklaus added it. Yeah,
right. And yep. it's a stunning par three now, and it's a tough hole too. And then primarily they've just added a lot of bunkers. You know, there were no bunkers up the right side at two. There were no bunkers on the far side of the third fairway. You know, the bunkers on 14, they've added to, you know, to catch the balls because, you know, with the distance these guys are hitting it today, a lot of those bunkers wouldn't even be relevant today in today's time. So it's primarily just, you know, modernizing the golf course.
Yeah, and do you think architecturally, you know, what do you love about the layout? What do you love about how the cliffs are used, that sort of thing?
Well, obviously, the stunning beauty of the golf course is just kind of takes your breath away. But the thing about Pebble is it's not tricked up. I mean, it's right in front of you. I mean, and you know, if you hit a lot of good shots and play well, you can score here. But if you don't, you know, you're going to pay the price. So what I like about it architecturally is that it's relevant still today, and it's like I said, it's right in front of you. It's nothing tricked up about it. The greens are not tricked up. They're not, you don't have a bunch of buried Volkswagens in the greens. The greens are very subtle. They're difficult, but you know they're very playable.
Yeah, and you know what are you watching for this year when you're gonna see the tournament in June? I mean, do you think the USGA is worried that people can go low if there's good weather? Do you think, you know, Koepka and Johnson can overpower the golf course these days?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I really don't know. I don't think that this golf course rewards a bomber as much as, like, Bethpage. I think that a guy that, you know, is in the middle of the pack in terms of distance, but as maybe more accurate off the tee, will be rewarded here as well. But having said that, it just blows me away what Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson they're able to do. Not only are they super long, they hit it straight too. So it's hard to say. I mean, obviously they're going to be favorites. I mean, Tiger's clearly a sentimental favorite. He's done very well here. He feels at home here, and as does Phil Mickelson. What a story that would be for Phil to win, you know, the last, you know, leg of the Grand Slam here at Pebble. I mean, that's the only tournament he hasn't won, the only major that he hasn't won. So I think it's going to be an absolutely fantastic tournament, and it could be a surprise winner, too. Could be a Matt Kuchar.
You've been in the gallery here for a lot of the, you know, U.S. Opens. What do you remember? Is there any specific moment somewhere you were standing or a shot you saw or a cheer that you felt throughout the golf course?
Well, I can't really tell you that I was standing on the 17th tee when Jack Nicklaus hit the one iron off the, flagstick. And the other thing about having been inside the ropes for several years, I'm not the greatest galleryite in the world. You know, I get a little impatient when there's, you know, I can't see anything. There's thousands of people. And so, like I mentioned at the PGA Championship, though, they did a sudden death. And, you know, Gene Littler ended up winning on the third playoff hole. So I was right there for that. So that was really pretty
cool. Yeah, not many people realize there was a PGA Championship here at Pebble as well.
Yeah, 77.
Yeah. So what's amazing is, you know, the historic run of championship golf that's happening in the Bay Area. You've got next year the PGA Championship at Harding Park. It's the first on the West Coast since 1998. Then you've got at Pebble the 2023 U.S. Women's Open, and the 2027 U.S. Open comes back. Then Cypress Point gets a Walker Cup in 2025. And Olympic Club's going to be very busy because it has the 2021 U.S. Women's Open. Then it goes to the PGA Championship in 2028 and a Ryder Cup in 2032. So, you know, that's an amazing stretch of golf. Just talk a little bit about, you know, the Bay Area's impact.
Well, I think it's deserved. I mean, this is, you know, some of the greatest golf courses in the world in Northern California. And the other thing I would say, and I'm not in this side of the business, but, you know, you can almost rest assured that you're not going to be delayed with weather with these major championships in Northern California. And the other thing is that, you get, like, primetime broadcast to the East Coast. So I think there's a lot of there are a lot of compelling reasons to have major championships on the West Coast, other than these are some iconic golf courses that clearly deserve to host these events.
Yeah, it makes a lot of business sense. You've got weather, you've got population, you've got, you know, iconic courses. Yeah, adds up.
And you've got natural beauty. I mean, there's no more photographic golf course in the world than Pebble on a nice day. I'm just hoping it's not fogged in all week.
Hey guys, Matt Ginella here, and thanks for listening to the Golf Advisor Podcast. It's no secret our annual golf vacations or buddies trips are often the highlights of our year. If only you didn't have to do all the planning. Not only have we taken care of that, as we've lined up some memorable golf getaways this year, but we're also extending you an invite. Join me on a Golf Advisor getaway where we take care of every detail. Get tee times for an ultimate itinerary, maximizing your value, access, and experience. Plus, you'll walk away with some gear and good stuff, courtesy of our partners. To learn more about our upcoming getaways and to book your spot on the roster, visit golfadvisor.com/getaways.
You know, we're talking about Bay Area golf. You've kind of ridden through the highs and lows of it as a course owner. You built the course, Stevenson Ranch, and it had a good run, but you had to close it. And now you're at Karika Park, kind of handling a rebirth there. Just talk about, you know, the sustainability and the ebb and flow of golf and being an operator in Northern California.
Well, it's tough business. I mean, it's really challenging. And, when, you know, you guys are, you know, associated with the Golf Channel, and that whole, you know, Golf Now has changed everything and the dynamic for golf course owners. And, you know, and some people, you know, hate it, and some people think it's great, and other people think it's a necessary evil. We're of the mindset that people are geared towards looking on the internet if they're traveling for lodging, for restaurants, for a place to play golf. And so we embrace, you know, Golf Now, but we control it quite carefully and don't, you know, allow the tee times to get discounted too much. But the discounting of tee times has really caused some economic challenges for golf course owners and operators, and it's tough. But the thing is, golf is not going away. It's the greatest game in the world, and people are going to continue to play this game. And if you're located in with good demographics, with good population base around you, and you know, and household income, and you provide a really good experience and a good value for people, They're gonna embrace it. They're gonna keep coming, and I'm also very excited. I think that the millennials are really starting to get more involved in golf, and they're starting to realize that being connected with your smartphone 24/7 is not the healthiest thing in the world, and that there are other things that matter. And spending 4 hours or 5 hours with close friends on the golf course, socializing and having fun, is really important. And my son's 27 years old, and he's kind of come back to the game, and he loves it. And so I'm very bullish. I think that we've hit the bottom in the golf industry in terms of participation. I think it's not booming, but we're slowly coming out of the trough, so to speak. And I think that the next 10 years, obviously the resurgence of Tiger and, you know, Brooks Koepka and the golf is relevant again.
Is the biggest challenge in Northern California, is it water costs? Is it drought related? Is it just the general difficulty of, like you say, attracting millennials and growing the game?
It's kind of all of the above. I mean, water is a huge, huge deal, and that's what we did at Karika. When we first, coming up on our seventh year there, when we first took over that lease, our water costs were around $600,000 for a year. And that's a very, very difficult nut to crack. And the other thing that's difficult about it is with these municipal water districts and agencies, they just kind of arbitrarily raise rates. So you can reduce your water usage 30%, but it's likely that they might raise the rates 40%. So it's challenging. So what we did at Karika is we put in a very elaborate drainage system that the South Course, they drains to two large ponds. So we are able in a normal rainfall year to harvest enough water that we don't need to use any supplemental water outside. So we're basically, our water bill right now is like less than $50,000 a year. And so if you don't have a really good, reliable, and inexpensive water source, and you're in California, anywhere in California, it's gonna be difficult to survive in the golf industry.
Yeah, and maybe this is a tough subject for you, but do you have regrets about what happened at Stevenson Ranch? Have you moved on? How hard of a decision was that to close it a couple of years ago?
It was very painful. It's very emotional. Put, over 20 years of blood, sweat, and tears into that property. And we were recognized as, Golf Magazine or Golf World, I think, recognized as top 50 public course in America. And what I've said often is there are a lot of courses closing in America, but not a lot of great ones. And it was really a great golf course. And what's helped me get through that is a lot of my friends have said to me, don't feel bad. You gave it everything you had. You worked your butt off to make that thing profitable and successful. And what you did do is you created so many great memories for so many people that will live with you forever. And you can be really proud of that and be happy to look back on it. It's creating memories, and that's the way I look at it. And so that's the way I've gotten over it. And certainly I don't miss the family meetings where talking about the negative cash flow.
I got to play it once when I moved out here to California in 2014, and I was thrilled I got to play it before it closed. It was a really fun golf course. I spent the night at the property. Like you say, just a lot of good memories. You ran it right, but just for a confluence of reasons, you made the decision, and now we move on. And your next labor of love is Karika Park. So you found your next passion.
Yeah, I guess I'm not smart enough to, I just got up off the mat and kept going, taking a few more punches. But
that's the symbol of the game, right? I mean, we all make triple bogeys, and then suddenly we come back and try again, right?
Exactly. You got to keep swinging. So at Karika, though, I'm really excited about it because all those things that I mentioned earlier, the demographics, the population base, the history of the property. At one time, it was one of the busiest munis in America, I think only second to Torrey Pines. We had some historical data, and 1999 and 2000, that property did 240,000 starts, which is inconceivable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just hard to imagine. And people have told me stories that if you didn't have a tee time on a Saturday morning, you had to get there around 4, put your name in, and then you go back to your car and go to sleep, or they had the coffee shop open, you can go have coffee or breakfast or whatever.
The West Coast Bethpage Black almost. Yeah,
exactly, yeah. So very similar. And now we're seeing with the redo of the par 3, the driving range, and the South Course, we're seeing kind of a resurgence of that. It's pretty amazing. We are absolutely slammed. We have our first tee time at 6:10 in the morning, especially on the weekend, 6:10, and we run almost nonstop till about 4:30. So we're getting, and what we're getting is a lot of repeat business. So we're not, a lot of times when you open a new golf course, you get a real bump in the participation in the rounds for, you know, a few months while people are checking it out for the first time, and then it drops off again.
Yeah.
Well, what we're finding is that the trend is up all the way. I mean, it's just, we're getting more and more rounds, and we're getting more and more people that are coming back. So that's very refreshing. And the North Course is going to be a very exciting course when we're finished, when hopefully within like two and a half years from now. That's going to be very different, though. The South Course is like an Australian sandbelt style course with about 112 bunkers on it. It plays real fast and firm, huge greens, very pretty much generous fairways. Ball runs a lot. It's fast course. The North Course is going to be much shorter, only going to have in the neighborhood of 20 bunkers. There's going to be a lot of water, though. We're expanding some of the water features out there, again, increasing the capacity for recapture of runoff and drainage water. So it's going to be a shorter course, probably 6,500, 6,600 from the tips. And but it'll be really enjoyable to play as well.
Yeah, Karika Park checks all the boxes. You got the par three for the kids or the family. You've got the driving range to work out the kinks. You've got the South Course, really fun to play. Has a lot of good kind of street cred out there. People say, have you played Karika? They say, yeah, I love it, man. Yep. And then, you know, the new North Course will give something entirely different. You have the Link Soul, you know, pro shop there. So lot going on in that project. Very exciting.
Yeah, it is really exciting. And, you know, you mentioned Link Soul. You know, having that partnership with John Ashworth has been great. You know, John and I are friends, and we've always talked about, why does every pro shop in America have to look the same? You know, so you walk into the pro shop at Karika, and, you know, you'll see surfboards, you'll see skateboards, you'll see ping pong tables. It's just a different feel and look, and it's just people – as their first impression, they walk in, they go, wow, they know that they're at a place that's unique, and that's been great. And it's only going to get better because we're still renovating the clubhouse, and, you know, we're putting in an event center, and so the property is continuing to evolve. The city is actually going to be redoing the parking lot, thankfully, because it's a mess when you first arrive. But no, it's an exciting project, and I'm looking forward to the future there.
Well, we want to give our listeners one final, deep dive into the Monterey Peninsula, and I'm going to do some rapid fire questions. You being a local for so long, so just give us some tips. What would be the best time to come visit the Monterey Peninsula?
No question in my mind, October.
And why is that?
Because you have the best weather. You're past the foggy season, as you know. The visitors to the Monterey Peninsula know you can, in the June, July, and August, and even parts of September, it can be pretty foggy here. You have the marine layer, but October is typically got beautiful weather.
And everybody wants to come out here and play Pebble, but, you know, there are some other golf courses on this peninsula. What would you consider kind of like a value course or a hidden sort of gem where some people might not know about?
Well, you know, everybody refers to it as a poor man's Pebble Beach, but Pacific Grove Golf Links is probably the best value and fun golf course on the peninsula. Another good value and another good property is Bayonet and Black Horse. And then if you happen to be an NCGA member, a member of the Northern Cal Golf Association, Poppy Hills is still fantastic value.
Yeah, all good golf courses, no doubt about that. And, you know, if you're here on a buddy's trip, where are you hanging out? Where would be a... One, give us a good restaurant to go to, and two, a place to maybe hang out or have some drinks.
Well, no question that the Mission Ranch, Clint Eastwood's property down by the Carmel Mission, is really a cool place to hang out and drinks. And they've got a piano bar going every night, and it's just it's kind of the place to be. And many nights you might even see Clint. He spends quite a bit of time in there. And then... favorite restaurants, I've kind of gotten because I don't live here anymore, I've got a little bit out of the loop on that, but there's I have a restaurant in Pacific Grove that I think is fantastic called Fandango. So that would be my two properties that I recommend.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time here today. You've dropped a lot of knowledge on us. Pebble Beach should be an amazing host for the U.S. Open. Part of me wishes it would fog in a little bit and give them some wind and rain to teach those boys a lesson, but also it would be great to have amazing weather for the spectators and to see all the beautiful views on TV.
Well, I'm pretty sure we're not going to have four perfect days of weather, so I think your wish is probably going to come true, so we'll see. I hope we have at least a couple of good, nice, sunny days with, you know, that you can just walk the park and just enjoy the views and the spectacular golf. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. I appreciate it. Thanks, George.
Thanks, Jason.